Hello, and welcome to Foreign Entanglements. I'm Matt Duss. I'm with the Center for American Progress and a columnist for the American Prospect. With me again is Gil Troy, a professor of history at McGill University and author of the new book, Moynihan's Moment. Welcome, Gil.
Great to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for doing this again. Let's see, this past weekend, we saw the annual policy conference of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. You wrote a piece about this in the Open Zion website at the Daily Beast. Why don't you go ahead and just kind of share some of your thoughts that you had in the piece and other things?
Well, the piece was originally entitled The Sweetness of AIPAC, and I think the way they ran it was AIPAC Feeling the Love. I was a newbie. It was my first time at AIPAC, and I had, I guess, you know, absorbed some of the negative press. I call it actually the AIPACing of AIPAC, where they've made AIPAC into this, you know, big bad lobby, and you expected this kind of angry edge and deep political manipulation going on. And what most struck me was, as I said, the sweetness, that there was such sincerity, there was such earnestness, 13,000 people there, overwhelmingly Jewish, of course, but many non-Jews, many blacks, many Latinos, who just, at the end of the day, love Israel. And they don't understand why Israel is so unfairly attacked. There's room for criticism, and there was, in the panels that I was on, people talked about, you know, some of the complexity of the Palestinian issue in the territories. But on the whole, what I just didn't expect was just how sweet and almost goofy, in a naive and innocent way, the whole conference was.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't attend this year. I have attended, I think, three different conferences in the past. You know, I guess coming from a slightly different political orientation than you, I mean, I can see a lot of what you were saying. I mean, it is, you know, it's built to be positive. I think conferences like this are built, you know, I mean, the goal of these things is basically to affirm and reinforce already existing views, and to give conference goers who do not live and breathe this issue and who are visiting Washington a sort of mountaintop experience, if you'll excuse that term.
Yeah, it was a pep rally, definitely a pep rally.
Yeah, basically, yeah, it's a pep rally, but yeah, I mean, there's definitely substance to it. I mean, there are some of the panels I think have been very good, but in general, I mean, it's not like you're, and this, you know, this is, no policy conference is really like this, but it's not like you're there to get a broad, complex view of what's going on. I mean, let's be honest about what AIPAC's role is and what AIPAC's orientation is. I think Chemi Shalev and Haaretz had a very, very good piece on this yesterday, where he was saying, you know, let's be clear. I mean, you're not going there to get a rigorous understanding of the Palestinian point of view. You are getting a fairly slanted take on the situation. And that's part of AIPAC's mission, which is, of course, to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship, not to give you a really detailed analysis of all the various parties' claims.
No, absolutely. It's not an academic conference. It's a policy conference of a political action committee. But one of the things I find interesting about that comment is, if someone went to a feminist conference or someone went to a gay and lesbian conference, would they write about how it's so surprising that there wasn't a sexist point of view or there wasn't a homophobic point of view? You know, when you go to these kind of pep rallies, there's an expectation that you're playing to the partisans. But somehow or other, there's this constant vibe, and it comes within the Jewish community. I'm not, you know, claiming anti-Semitism or some, you know, vast dark conspiracy. Within the Jewish community itself, there's a thing of, oh my goodness, we haven't, you know, given the other side enough room to breathe. Now, I think there are certain formats where you absolutely want to have both sides, but there are certain formats where the issue is much more a matter of, we're all pro-Israel, what do we do? And for example, in one of the panels that I was on, we can't go into details because it's kind of Chatham House rules, but there was definitely a range of political opinions. Most of the opinions were definitely two-state and more to the left of Bibi Netanyahu. And the interesting thing is they have about 375 speakers, I think is the number, you know, very high quality, all interested in acknowledging the complexity of the conflict, while also clearly in that context being pro-Israel.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I mean, first, just to step back for a minute, I would, perhaps comparing the pro-Palestinian point of view to sexism and homophobia is not the best, but I mean, I think your point is very well taken. But I think that's the exact point I'm getting at is, this is a very, I think no one would argue a very powerful lobbying organization, a very effective lobbying organization. And it's, I think you can point to certain panels in which certain points of view are expressed, but at the end of the day, I think it really goes to, okay, what is AIPAC actually doing? And its resolutions and its work is, I think obviously to anyone, it's pushing a very, very one-sided series of measures. And that has an impact on, a serious impact on the rules of the road in Congress, on the debate as it's carried out in Congress. I think, presidents, depending on what they want to do, certainly have a serious bit of power in carrying out policies. But, the fact of the matter is AIPAC is very effective at constraining certain options on Capitol Hill. And again, that's not, I think a lot of people would see that as be scared by that. But again, this is just because they're an effective lobbying organization. There are many lobbying organizations that are effective at doing that sort of thing. But I think there are serious and some serious negative implications to the work that AIPAC does. When you have just this, and again, I think you're right to note that a lot of the people who attend this and a lot of people in Congress who hew to AIPAC's point of view do so from a position of goodwill. And I think that's a very important thing to recognize. But at the end of the day, you have a set of measures in Congress that are pushed by AIPAC that are, really, in my view, not reflective of the reality of the situation. And of course, that's debatable, but also not reflective of what I think we know about American public opinion.
Well, first of all, a number of things. First, I appreciate the clarification. I'm not comparing being pro-Palestinian with being sexist or homophobic. I was just saying that, when you have a conference mm-hmm. that's about a certain kind of point of view, right. That's the point of view. So I appreciate right. that clarification.
Secondly, right. If it was an NRA conference, you would not expect right. to see a massive representation of gun control advocates.
Exactly. Or perhaps anybody from New York City, but that's a whole other conversation. second is that, AIPAC is an effective lobby, but it has its wins and it has its losses. Mm-hmm. Note its silence regarding the Chuck Hagel defense appointment, which was clearly a strategic silence. I don't think many people in AIPAC were mm-hmm. very excited about that nomination. Right. Third is, sure. I think many of the positions that AIPAC takes are actually quite in concert with American public opinion, which often is to the right of American Jewish public opinion. Frequently, mm-hmm. and certainly American Jewish elite public opinion, when some polls have been run about where you stand on a Palestinian state, you often find that there are American Jews and certainly American Jewish elites who are more open to that idea. But when you broaden it up to the American public tends to be, on the whole, quite enthusiastically pro-Israel and quite hawkish on the Israel issue.
Well, again, let's separate out what we mean by that. I think in terms of supporting a two-state solution, I think from the polls that I've seen, and if you've seen others, please share. I mean, it's just in general, it's a fair majority, not a strong majority, but it ranges within, 55 to 65% that support the creation of a Palestinian state, sometimes lower. But yes, when asked, do you favor the Israelis over the Palestinians? Consistently for many years, you've gotten much more favor Israel than favor the Palestinians, okay. And there are a number of interesting reasons for that that we can talk about. But I think the view that I'm talking about is when asked, do you think the U.S. which side should the U.S. favor, the Israelis, the Palestinians, or neither? When you look at something like the Chicago Public Affairs Council polls that are carried out every few years that are very well regarded, you get something like 65% of respondents who believe that when negotiating Middle East peace, the United States should favor neither party and work with both to achieve a resolution. Now, I think what's interesting about that is when you look at, okay, who are the – you have something like 30% who say we should favor the Israelis and something like 3 to 5% who say we should favor the Palestinians. I think that's where you really see – which side is more motivated and more empowered to kind of push for that particular policy.
Correct. That also gets into the whole question of America's role in the world and America's role mm-hmm. as, global media, a global mediator, a global cop. And, mm-hmm. And one of the things, and I think we're seeing this around the speculation about as building up toward Barack Obama's trip to Israel is exactly how can the United States help? One of the great ironies, of course, is, mm-hmm. American presidents use their benchmark that great moment, and it was an extraordinary moment, not just in American history, not just in Jewish history, but in world history, when Jimmy Carter brought Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin together and helped negotiate what was inconceivable at the time. We forget how inconceivable that seemed to be, an Egyptian-Israeli peace settlement, a treaty which has held, I'm happy to point out. We should also point out, though, that the biggest breakthrough in Palestinian-Israeli negotiations came through the Oslo peace process, which by its name started in Norway and not in the United States. And then President Clinton was smart enough and gracious enough to embrace it and move it along. But sometimes the United States is very helpful, and sometimes the United States is neutral or not even helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, I think those are all excellent points. I mean, I think, but just bringing it back to, you know, when you, to my point about AIPAC and, you know, the measures that they support in Congress, they just do not reflect in any sense this idea that the U.S. should be a neutral arbiter between the Israelis and Palestinians. And, you know, and that's fine. I mean, that's not what AIPAC's
about.
That
is not their goal.
But I think it's very – excuse me?
That is not their goal, I agree.
Right. So, I mean, I think it's very fair to point out, and you and I discussed this in our previous blogging heads, you know, it's very clear, I think it's not even debatable, that Americans by and large support Israel for a number of reasons. They, you know, one is just, you know, kind of political, religious, cultural affiliation. There's just a kind of a tendency through, you know, if we want to even use the term Judeo-Christian society, we just identify with the Jewish narrative in America in a way we simply don't with the Palestinian narrative.
No, and that frankly was one of the
go ahead.
No, and that actually was one of the, you know, most moving parts of the AIPAC conference, speaking to some Latino leaders, speaking to some African American ministers, and to hear the tremendous love and commitment they have to the safety of people all over the region, but, you know, particularly they were talking about their commitments to Israel and the Jewish people, and you just go like, you know, it's one thing, you kind of expect someone within your own particular ethnic group to be rah-rah, sis-boom-ba, and all for it. But when someone from outside comes in and gives you that kind of embrace and hug, especially when we live in a world with so much delegitimization, especially when we live in a world where, you know, the Turkish premier calls the Zionism a crime against humanity, you see the difference. And it's an extraordinary story about America. It's an extraordinary story about, you're right, a kind of a concert of values and a feeling between Americans and Jews. It's a great love affair, and it's actually been very good, I think, for everyone involved.
You know, well, first, again, I mean, I relate to what you're saying. I mean, I wrote a piece for Open Zion a few months ago in response to David Brog, a spokesman for Christians United for Israel, because, I mean, that is my background as well, is the Christian Evangelical Church, a fairly, you know, Christian Zionist point of view. I was raised in just a kind of acceptance of Israel as the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Not to say that's what's driving every, you know, non-Jews' view of this or even the majority of Christians, but that is a very real thing. But I think in more general terms, it's just – it's a familiarity and a tendency and a kind of, you know, a prejudice, if you will, toward one side of the conflict, such that I was not even aware that there was an alternative narrative, that the Palestinians had this other point of view until much later. And that's – again, I mean, it's not AIPAC's job to tell the Palestinian side of the story, but the fact of the matter is there is this alternative narrative. It is a real thing. It needs to be addressed, and it's just AIPAC's role in really ignoring, if not suppressing, that narrative, I think has some, you know, negative implications for U.S. policy.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the word like suppressing, because that implies a kind of, you know, dictatorial, totalitarian heavy hand that we don't have in our free society. But certainly, you know, AIPAC is perpetuating, you know, is committed to a certain take, and has its agenda, as do, you know, all the lobbies on Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Moving on to AIPAC's asks this year. There were two big ones that were first reported by Ron Campeas at JTA. One was the elevating of, like, the kind of formalizing and codifying of the U.S.-Israel special relationship by naming Israel as a major strategic ally, which is a category that has been apparently created just for Israel. And it's unclear entirely what, you know, what this would commit the United States to. again, it's, you know, what the legal implications of this would be. And the second one that I wrote about yesterday in the American Prospect that I think is more troubling is this resolution. And granted, it's non-binding, but again, we get into the question of here of kind of creating parameters for this discussion. Is a resolution from the Senate first. It was Menendez and Graham who sponsored it first in the Senate, and there's another one very similar to it in the House, committing the United States to supporting Israel in the event that Israel strikes the Iranian nuclear program. And I just think that this is altogether a bad thing. I mean, we had, as I wrote in my piece, you know, some Henry Kissinger commented on this last year when it was just being rumored. He's like, it's just inconceivable that the United States would give this sort of blank check to any country. It's fine and good and appropriate to say that Israel should, you know, determine how best to defend itself on its own. But then to say that, you know, once Israel makes that decision, the United States is bound to back it up. I mean, that's essentially subcontracting U.S. defense policy to a client state. And I'm trying to think of any time, not only in U.S. history, but really in world history, where I've ever seen that state of affairs existing.
I'm going to disappoint you because I agree with you. I went to AIPAC as a speaker, not as a member or or someone who marches in line. I'll give a little bit of nuance in that, you know, I think on the two resolutions, you know, there's as a historian, I tend to think less legalistically and less legislatively and more conceptually. So the two core concepts behind each of those pieces of legislation are things with which I completely agree. One, that whatever piece of law you have or not, Israel is indeed a major strategic ally of the United States, that there are deep ties that, you know, we talked about before, values, common interests, and now also kind of the institutional ties between the militaries, among other things. And on Iran, there is a, you know, little Satan and big Satan are in this together. And, you know, everybody tends to focus on the way the Iranians love to target rhetorically little Satan, i.e. Israel. But they as often will bash the United States, big Satan. And I have to say, as an American, I'm quite offended by not only the degree to which they do it, but the degree to which we sort of take it for granted. And we should have not lost our capacity for outrage. We should remember that this is just outrageous, some of the things they say about our country, about the United States of America. Mm-hmm. Having said that, where I agree with you is that as an American, as an American historian, I think it's bad policy to create policy handcuffs. And it's especially bad policy to make policy of the future. So to start legislating what should happen if this happens reminds me of the, you know, substitute teacher who comes in and says, if you guys say this, I'm gonna punish you. And it creates a dynamic that first of all, it boxes you in, right? And as an American president, an American Congress, you don't want to be boxed in. So, you know, conceptually, I think I'm probably a little more enthusiastic about the connection. In this particular case, on those two, on the sort of technical aspects of those two pieces of legislation, I share your worries.
Yeah.
Sorry, it doesn't make for good fireworks, but you know.
No. I think that is very interesting because it does get to something that really interests me here. Is that it gets to a problem I think with Congress is that, you know, hawkishness in Congress, especially hawkishness toward Iran right now, is one of the easiest political lifts you can ask for. It's a very, very easy way for members of Congress, especially someone like Lindsey Graham, who's facing a potential primary challenge in South Carolina, which partially explains why he's made such a pain of himself over the past few months on a whole range of issues. But at the end of the day, it is just bad policy. Especially here we are 10 years after the invasion of Iraq, coming up on the anniversary. And it's important to look back, and I think James Fallows had a good piece on this, Daniel Larrison, both of which I think I referenced in my piece. It's like, it's important to look back at the steps that were taken in the years preceding the invasion that really had the effect of ratcheting up America's, you know, aggressiveness, kind of acclimating American voters toward this idea that war was inevitable. Now, granted, we are in a sort of cold conflict with Iran and have been for years. Sometimes it gets hot. But I think the reason for that is that all sides have an interest in it remaining that way for now. But I don't see any positive aspect to continuing to ratchet up or, you know, raise the temperature in this way. I think that's bad for the United States. I think that's bad for Israel. And I think we have, you know, numerous comments from Israeli current and ex-military officials that would back that up.
Well, if I may say three things. First of all, you're playing also into one of my biases, which is as a presidential historian, I have a lot of distrust of Congress when it comes to domestic policy as well as foreign policy. And I'll just say Obamacare. I count five people on the Republican side and five people on the Democratic side, perhaps, who can explain this, you know, unwieldy piece of legislation. I'm not commenting on the rights and wrongs of national health care. I'm talking about what happened when he contracted it out to Congress. So I share your bias, you know, my fears of either making domestic policy or foreign policy through the Congress. That's number one. Number two, I think we have to be careful with our language. I haven't seen many people calling for war with Iraq. At most, people are talking about a military operation, which might be necessary if Iran rushes ahead with its nuclear plans. And that's very different. And in fact, there also are articles that have been making their way into the press saying, you know, this could be done in one day potentially, that or 2 days, that it doesn't necessarily need to lead to war if we're talking about the attack on Iran. So you know, a military operation, as we saw with the Osirak attack against Iraq and the attack on the Syrian nuclear reactors in 2007, doesn't necessarily lead to Iraq, Afghanistan, World War II. Three, more broadly, I think you and I are probably on the same page, which is that to the extent that sanctions can work, to the extent that cyber warfare, which of course the United States and Israel would never ever engage in, can work. To the extent that,
it's good to note that.
To the extent that, in some ways, even the rhetorical temperature can be raised such that the Iranians get the sense that the Israelis, the Americans, and I'd like to add the Europeans and the Western world are serious about this. We actually have an opportunity to perhaps avoid what Winston Churchill called war, and go to jaw. So there are many different dimensions here, and again, fundamentally, I agree that we don't want to end up in war, and we don't want to end up with American policy handcuffed. But this is a multidimensional, very complex issue, which starts with the fact that the Iranians have not been good citizens of the world. They have been major troublemakers. And an oil-rich country rushing toward nuclear power does raise many, many concerns.
Mm-hmm. Right. I want to go back to – and I think on that latter point, I you are right. We totally agree on that. I want to go back to your second point, though. I mean, and that is this idea that, you know, we can talk about strikes without really talking about war. I mean, if you have seen articles that make a serious case that this is a short operation, I'd love to see them, because the overwhelming consensus, as I gather it, both is that any operation that's going to have a serious chance of setting back the program, Not destroying it completely, because I think everyone agrees that's all but impossible, but seriously setting the program back is going to take days, if not weeks. I think the Osirak comparison has – I've not heard anyone who thinks that there's an Osirak operation that's possible here. And I do think it's also worth noting about Osirak is that Osirak was a short-term success and a longer-term failure. If Saddam Hussein had not been dumb enough to invade Kuwait and thereby, you know, getting the rest of the world to align against him and the U.S. to kick him out of Kuwait and send inspectors in, we would have never found that he had, in fact, restarted his nuclear weapons program and dispersed it. So, again, that I think that cuts against the idea that Osirak was an overall success. But getting back to the main point about Iran, you know, these points are controversial, but I think there's a fairly strong consensus that recognizes that strikes on Iran, either by Israel or the U.S., even though the U.S. could obviously achieve a lot more, you create a whole host of very, very bad consequences that could spiral out of control pretty quickly. So I think that's just all of that to say, I think we need to kind of cop to the fact that strikes, this will not be a clean 1-2 day operation. And those who talk about this possibility need to sort of recognize that.
I'm going to take refuge in my true position on this, which is that most of the time when I read things about the Iranian nuclear story, I don't believe them. I think that there's been tremendous amounts of of doublethink, of false claims and accusations. I think there's a whole series of smoke screens going on, and I simply say, as an outsider, someone who doesn't have inside military information, I just don't know. And I think there's a lot of posturing on both sides. I will say, however, as an American historian, let's look at America's track record, which is not good on this. America has a track record of being against nuclear proliferation in theory, but has not effectively stopped the North Koreans, has not effectively stopped the Indians, the Pakistanis, the Chinese. So what we've seen is we've had a lot of Lindsey Grahams. We've had a lot of people saying, I'm going to draw this line and we're not going to, and, you know, and that's, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about the, you know, the substitute teacher. And so one of the things I think we do have to put on the table, which goes back in some ways to the AIPAC conversation, is for me, it's very important. I'd say both as someone who cares about Israel and someone who cares about the United States, that whatever happens, it be done in a way that preserves American credibility.
Yeah.
And this conversation must preserve American credibility. And all too often, we get to too much posturing, too much bloviating, and we lose that. And that's, you know, when we step back, because I'll make things even more controversial. On the one hand, you know, I obviously don't want Iran to have the bomb because they've been a bad international player. But when I look at Iranian policy over the last 10, 12 years, even longer, 20 years, since the Iran-Iraq war, the Iranians have had a very careful strategic policy of not sacrificing Iranian lives to advance their foreign policy goals. And they've been extremely effective in that. They have used Hamas lives, Hezbollah lives, Jewish lives, Palestinian lives, they have Lebanese lives. They have no problem manipulating others, but they've actually been extremely cautious with Iranian lives after taking that hit to the regime, to the regime's credibility of losing a million or so men in the Iran-Iraq conflict. So,
I think the comment I've heard from more than one Middle East analyst is that Iran is quite willing to fight for the Middle East down to the last Arab.
Yes. And there is, and that actually does get to a huge thing about the Persians versus the Arabs, which you also find, by the way, in Egypt, there's a whole notion of the Pharaonic people, but we'll put that aside. So, that's why I would, if I were a policymaker, I would be extremely cautious about sacrificing any human lives to stop the Iranian nuclear program, well aware of the fact that the Iranians do have these set of handcuffs. On the other hand, I also see that they have been a bad actor on the international scene. So it's a very complicated situation. But again, I think a lot of it is there's just a lot of smoke and mirrors going on, and we have to be cautious about that.
I think that's very fair. One thing, I mean, good that you brought up North Korea. Just a couple quick points on that before we move on is that it is amazing to me how little taint remains on the Bush administration. I mean, of course, among nonproliferation nerds, you know, it's a big deal that the Bush administration and, of course, the Clinton administration talked a big, big game about not letting North Korea go nuclear. And of course, they did. But that's not really something you hear mentioned all the time in the bill of complaints against the George W. Bush administration, even though it's a very, very big deal. Second of all, North Korea, I mean, you know, President Obama took containment off the table. But for me, North Korea is actually, with regard to Iran, North Korea is one of the most important deterrents you can ask, you know, for Iran, in my view. Iran does not want to be North Korea. Iran has a very elevated view and ambitious view of its role in the region, the role it should play as a regional hegemon. And I cannot think they look at North Korea and say, yeah, that's the way we want to go. And I think that's the sort of I think we could do more to convince them that that's the situation they'd face if they cross the red line, such as it is, and test and obtain a nuclear weapon, rather than the threat of military strikes, which I think there's a fair case to be made. At least I've heard from Iranians themselves that such strikes would actually empower the regime more. Whereas facing the sort of mass international isolation that North Korea faces, I think that's something that really impacts the Iranian regime's thinking.
I agree with your analysis. I think that we have not done enough to really play this as a three-dimensional chess game. And there is a certain sense of Persian pride. The Iranians don't want to be known as international outlaws. I think that there's and I think there's more effective leadership that can be done in terms of stirring up dissent dissidents in Iran. I, for example, would say that, you know, one of my great disappointments with Barack Obama early on was when you had that Green Revolution against Ahmadinejad's reelection, and he was silent. And at that point, he was still the pop star Barack Obama. He was still that, international superstar who got the Nobel Peace Prize, and his silence for two or three critical weeks at that time, this was before the Arab Spring, was to me very, very disappointing. And I would love to see, you know, as I said earlier, economic sanctions, you know, cyber warfare, and some, you know, good old-fashioned but cautious, you know, playing to public opinion, international pride. And I do also worry that an attack on Iranian nuclear installations would lead to instead a kind of massive support for the regime. So it is a complicated situation. Mm-hmm. Best left to national security advisors, the conversations that are going to be occurring between Barack Obama and his advisors and Netanyahu and his advisors, mm-hmm. and best left out of the hands of the Congress.
Well, then we're in violent agreement there. So let's move on to Turkish Prime Minister mm-hmm. Erdogan's very unfortunate and offensive comments. I think it was it last week?
Yes. At a UN conference, we should point out.
At the UN Alliance of Civilizations conference. And this ties into some of the things that were said at the APEC conference about the problem of delegitimization, and your book, Moynihan's Moment, which talks about UN Representative Daniel Patrick Moynihan's work to oppose the Zionism as racism resolution in the UN in the 1970s. I wrote a piece about this as well with my colleague Michael Wirtz in response to Erdogan's comments. Michael is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress who heads up a lot of our Turkey work, and I do work with him on that. But again, a really, you know, a group, you know, categorizing Zionism as a crime against humanity. I mean, I think which even goes beyond what we've heard before from Erdogan and others. I mean, this is placing Zionism not just as racism, but as, you know, one of the most serious threats to global peace.
Right. This is an ideological and rhetorical escalation. It's deeply disturbing. It is rooted, as you point out, in the 1975 Zionism as Racism resolution, and it's part of a broader movement of delegitimization, which I keep on trying to emphasize through my book and through articles I've written in Open Zion lately, that this delegitimization movement is an obstacle to peace. The left should not see the fight against delegitimization as a right-wing issue. They should not see this as something that conservatives use to bash Palestinians. It's something that should be used to bash anti-peace, anti-Israeli, which is different than being pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli reactionary forces that want to radicalize the region. Mm-hmm. Because you pour all kinds of inflammatory material onto the region, which feeds the far right and the far left. It feeds the delegitimizers, and it feeds the people who are fighting peace. That's one point. The second point is we should talk about what happened at that conference, because the U.S. Secretary General is right there listening in, and the Turkish Premier Erdogan gets up, says what he says, and there's silence from the Secretary General. UN Watch, a small but very effective organization, an NGO which looks at these kind of things in the UN, starts spreading videos of this, and then the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, steps in and speaks very eloquently. Then we see John Kerry speaking in Turkey against it. And what that shows is two things. One is that all too often I fear that we've lost our capacity for outrage. We don't have Daniel Patrick Moynihan's around who step in immediately, who respond. But two, look what happened, that you had the Turkish Premier Erdogan speaking at this UN conference, right? Because the UN is no longer seen as this force necessarily as a place where you don't speak like that. And the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon initially didn't respond. But what happened was you have this plucky organization called UN Watch, which took a video of the conference and took the transcript of the conference and spread it around. And then you got the UN Secretary General saying what he should have said originally. You got Secretary of State John Kerry condemning the Turks in Turkey. And what that shows is two things. One is that in some ways we've lost our capacity for outrage. We've so accepted the attacks on Israel and on Zionism that we forget we don't have a Daniel Patrick Moynihan who stands up and says, this is an issue of morality, this is unacceptable. But two, that by shining a light on it and by working effectively, we can actually try to improve the situation in the region, to lower the rhetorical temperature, and to call out those people who are just going in and making trouble for no good reason.
So it was. I wasn't aware that it was UN Watch that first reported it. I think I saw it on Reuters. I mean, it was a public conference.
It was
right?
A public conference. My understanding is that it was UN Watch that spread the word and stirred up the reaction.
Okay. I mean, I'm aware of that group. I'd have to double check that. But I don't know. I think the U.S. has been. I mean, I think the U.S. has been fairly energetic in pushing back against this stuff. I think we can criticize Secretary Ban Ki-moon for not immediately reacting, but he did react the following day, and I think in fairly strong terms. So again, I think we're also in agreement that liberals and progressives need to do a better job of pushing back on delegitimization when it is actual delegitimization.
Right, and you were very eloquently about that in your piece.
Thank you. I think we need, but again, we also have that problem, and not to, you know, I think this is obvious and don't want to belabor it, but there is often an attempt to conflate delegitimization with Israel as a state, and delegitimization and criticism of the occupation. So I think progressives, and I include myself here, you know, try to walk that line between recognizing that the occupation is bad for Palestinians and bad for Israel and bad for the U.S., while also pushing back on this stuff, which completely crosses the line into delegitimizing Israel as such.
Right, and I think I've told you before that I always err on the side of not accusing someone of being a delegitimizer, of not accusing someone of being an anti-Semite, because there are so many people like Erdogan who so clearly cross the line. It's so important for me that we make a big, broad tent, a big cross-political alliance, that I don't want to get into ambiguity. And I actually teach this to students. I say, don't get involved in the ambiguous cases, in the questionable cases, because unfortunately there are too many people out there who do it with such hatred and in such a destructive way,
yeah.
And we need to unite together against those. And if we did enough of that work, then the rest, the people in the middle would start being more careful in their language. And I think that's what we saw in the reaction to Erdogan, led, I'm very proud to say, by John Kerry, who was in the uncomfortable position of actually being on a Middle East tour and showing up in Turkey and having to do that. And, you know, and that takes a certain kind of courage. We should give him some props, because the easier thing to do is to be diplomatic, as they call it. And again, Moynihan taught us that being diplomatic sometimes means standing up for core American ideals.
You know, just on Erdogan himself, I mean, just that point, knowing that the Secretary of State was about to visit, I mean, it does raise questions about Erdogan's own, you know, I don't want to say intelligence here, but his intelligence. You know, he's clearly decided that playing to this anti-Israel sentiment has benefits for him domestically, if not also in the region. But if you look at the impact it's made on his ability to broker between Israel and other parties, it's massively diminished it. And I think there's a strong case to be made that it's actually done real, real damage. And this is the point that my colleague Michael and I made in our piece. It's really diminished Turkey's role or its ability to play a productive role in the region. And yet Erdogan keeps doing this, so he clearly doesn't think so.
Right. He clearly seems to be motivated more by the domestic political gain that he's getting and is enjoying carving out his role. His new role as the demagogue, or one of the key leading demagogues of the Arab and Muslim world. But I agree with you that it's been incredibly destructive. I mean, there was, you know, there were strong economic ties between Israel and Turkey. There were strong military ties between Israel and Turkey. There were strong diplomatic ties between Israel and Turkey. And Turkey was in a position to really push effectively for not just Middle East peace, but for you know, an improved situation in the globe. And I would say, on the one hand, we saw his lack of judgment. And his desire more to play to the rafters, if you will, than to make the diplomatic trip of Kerry good. But on the other hand, I also wonder if he was, you know, showing a certain kind of contempt for Kerry and the Obama administration, and that's why, as an American, I'm extremely glad that Kerry came and in no uncertain terms was very clear about the fact that you can't take me down like this, and you can't humiliate me, you can't box me in. I'm not going to use our desire to be diplomatic as satin handcuffs. I'm going to stand for core principles, and we don't always see that, I'm sorry to say, in the West.
Right. I think that's a much, much better way to put it than you did. I'm questioning his judgment, not his intelligence. Right. Erdogan is clearly a very intelligent person. But, yeah, I mean, his own judgment about, you know, what he could and could not do, you know, because clearly Obama and various others have made it clear that Turkey is an important partner, especially now. So he's felt empowered to kind of, you know, to kind of run with this sort of stuff. But I totally agree with you that I was glad to see that Secretary Kerry commented on this as he did. So again, I mean, it's an important relationship. It'll continue to be for the United States, but I'm kind of, wondering where this goes from here with Erdogan, given the way that he seems intent on continuing to behave. So.
All right. And they have to start, what happens is bad actors like this have to start seeing the cost. And that goes back to the Iranian situation too. Right. I think for too long, there was a feeling of there's a vacuum in the West. There's a lack of leadership, in the West. And the more and here's the irony that it's, power's like a muscle. If when you use it effectively, it gets stronger. And for too long, we thought, if we don't use our power, then we'll be more popular. And we've learned that it actually doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I don't know if I would agree with that. I mean, I think it's just a question of how are we using power? I think, it's much less. I think the diplomatic engagement, especially at multilateral organizations, especially at the UN, I think the re-engagement there has been pretty significant under the Obama administration. I think you can point to certain successes. I would put the new sanctions on Iran at the UN Security Council. I would also put the creation of a special rapporteur for Iranian human rights, which I think is a very under-recognized success of the United States. Those are two obviously Iran-specific examples. But I guess it really does come down to how you are defining power.
Right. And I to go back to an earlier point of yours, I think we should, give credit to both the Barack Obama himself and to Susan Rice, who are in the UN. They've been very clear in fighting the delegitimization of Israel and saying this is just unacceptable. And that's important because it, as I argue, it has both diplomatic and political implications throughout the region.
So before we finish up, I just let you know, we have President Obama. We saw a report yesterday that even though Prime Minister Netanyahu is having some difficulties in forming a government, both Israeli and American officials said yesterday that President Obama's trip is on track. I don't know whether one can assume that means that a government is on the verge of being formed or what. But, assuming this does go forward, what would you like to see from this trip from the president?
First, let me just say one quick thing about the government. I think there's a week and a half left for the deadline. And lo and behold, I think as we get closer and closer to that deadline, we're going to see some real progress. I think that there's a lot of brinksmanship, which is unhealthy and not constructive, but that's the way the system is currently functioning or not functioning. I think there are two things that that one should look for in the trip. One is I think it's just really important, and people underestimate how important this is, especially for the Israeli people, for the Jewish people. Just they need a hug. They need a presidential hug. They need some presidential love. They need to see that Obama hearts Israel. And it's amazing how easy a mark Israel and the Jewish people are on this. Just a couple of symbolic moves, and it will really make a difference. And it's not just and it goes to deep senses of Jewish insecurity. We could talk for the next hour and a half about it. And also because of the delegitimization, because of the hostile environment, it's very important that this trip not just go off flawlessly, but that Obama figure out ways to broadcast that love. And so, for example, one of the things he's doing, I understand reading from the newspaper this morning, is he doesn't want to speak in the Israeli Knesset, in the Israeli Congress, in the Parliament building. He wants to speak to an audience filled mostly with students in the convention center, Binyan Omah. And that's a way of saying, I want to speak to the Israeli people. My guess is also it's a way of paralleling the Cairo speech, which took place in a university setting rather than in a parliamentary setting. So that's the kind of thing, at the APEC conference, Elliot Abrams talked about how the president has to show that it's in his kishkes, which is a Yiddish expression, like in his gut, that it's sort of like a gut love for Israel. The second question, which is much harder one to predict, and I think that's an easy one to predict. The second question, which is much harder to predict, and it's interesting to see Israeli analysts going really all over the board on this, is the president trying to prepare the groundwork for a second pass at the Middle East, at some kind of Middle East peace? We saw that in the first term, he kind of stumbled and then pulled back. He stumbled both politically and diplomatically, I would argue. But we've recently seen that Abbas was in Saudi Arabia meeting with American officials, that there seems to be some kind of movement. And in the New York Times this week, Dennis Ross actually laid out a very interesting plan, which what I liked about it was it was putting obligations both on the Israelis and on the Palestinians, both obligations that they could do unilaterally and that need to be done together in concert. And if nothing else, the presidential visit is encouraging that kind of optimism, that kind of thinking, that kind of brainstorming, And if indeed the president decides that this is the time is right, and we should point out that many analysts are emphasizing that one of the big problems is the Palestinian side is very much in disarray, that you have President Abbas, first of all, worried about Hamas and the continuing division in the Palestinian movement. And secondly, you have President Abbas in quotation marks, because whereas Netanyahu just got reelected with all the complexities of the Knesset and his basically failed reelection campaign, which didn't amass the kind of power Netanyahu was hoping for, but it was a campaign and it was an election and it was a validation and it's got legitimacy. And Abbas has just been governing on fumes for years. So
we're like, what, 3-4 years overdue for an election?
For an election. So he's really a president without a mandate in a non-country that's deeply divided. And that's not the recipe for progress in peace. Right. But we often see, especially second-term presidents, especially second-term Democratic presidents, have this Jimmy Carter standard that, I want to beat that guy in the Camp David game. And I think that may be one of the things that's making Obama...
Well, Republican presidents, too. Look at Annapolis.
Yes, so. No, that's true. But there's a particular thing, you know, there was that Clinton thing and the Carter thing. And if it's constructive, I'm all for it. But it needs to be done thoughtfully, needs to be done with good homework, and it needs to be done in a way that doesn't inflame the region, but that pushes ahead. Because, you know, in so many ways, for so many people, the contours of a peace agreement, or at least a restart of the peace process, have been there for so long. Now it's just a matter of creating the right conditions so that it doesn't destabilize the region, but actually is a constructive force.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Gil. Great talking to you.
Great talking to you, and hope always springs eternal in the Middle East.
Yeah. All right.
Great.
Have a good one.
Thanks, you too.